Hi, I'm Brian Nash, the host of the How We Got Here podcast, and welcome to Episode 8, What If Benedict Arnold Was Responsible for the World's Best Scallops? I want to thank you, my loyal listeners, for taking the time to listen to my podcast. If you'd like to get a sneak peek behind the scenes and extra content as well as other benefits, become a supporter and visit our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/howwegothere pod.
Welcome to How We Got Here, a genealogy podcast hosted by Brian Nash, exploring the tools, tips, and resources for genealogists from Atlantic Canada and family historians from around the globe who are researching their ancestors from Atlantic Canada. Every family has a story, so stick around as Brian and his guests share the unique family stories that help shape the history and culture of Atlantic Canada.
Welcome to today's episode. Today I will be talking to historian and author Brian McConnell about his latest book, The Loyalists of Digby. Digby is the name of a county in a small town on the coast of the Bay of Fundy on the southwest shore of Nova Scotia. The Digby area is world famous for its scallop fishery and was originally founded after the rebellion of 1776 in the lower colonies of British North America. This was the rebellion led by that traitor to the king, George Washington, and his rebel army, where they overthrew the rightful government. Okay, just excuse me, I'm just getting in the mindset of a loyalist for today's episode. I really don't believe those things, though I do like to wish my American friends Happy Treason Day every 4th of July, and remind them any time their politics gets a little too loony down there that we'd gladly welcome them back to the Empire. So, getting back to the matter at hand, I was really excited to have Brian McConnell back to the podcast to talk about his latest book. I hope you find our discussion about the Loyalists of Digby as enjoyable and informative as I did. So I'd like to welcome back to the How We Got Here podcast, Brian McConnell. I've had him before. He was talking about his book, Canada's Ulster Scots. And today he's going to be talking about his latest book, The Loyalists of Digby. Brian, as get started here, just what was the inspiration for doing this book and specifically concentrating on the community of Digby?
Just by way of a bit of background, Brian, for someone who may not know, I've been involved in the Loyalist Association in Nova Scotia for a number of years, the United Empire Loyalists, and presently the president of the Nova Scotia branch. And I'm descended from a soldier who served in the Loyal Rangers during the American Revolution. I have no ancestors in Nova Scotia, but I have lived for over 30 years near Digby. And I've been writing and researching on local history here, having belonged to a few of the historical societies. Of course, you don't have to go very far. The name itself, Digby, named after Admiral Digby, who was responsible for providing the ships to send the loyalists here. As a historian, it's a very fascinating subject.
And where did the loyalists in Digby, where did they primarily come from?
Well, this happened in June of 1783, when the loyalist refugees were being evacuated from New York. At the end of the American Revolution, when the treaty was done between the British government and the Americans, they provided that the loyalists there could all be withdrawn. So Sir Guy Carleton, the British commander, was based in New York. He was commander for all British forces in North America and had charge for this, along with Admiral Robert Digby, who'd been a naval captain, served in the Channel Fleet in the Mediterranean, and was appointed as a station commander of New York, which meant that he commanded all of the ships based out of New York. So there were a number of sailings. There was a spring sailing, a summer sailing, and a fall sailing of loyalists from New York to Nova Scotia, which then included New Brunswick. So as part of this, some ships went to Shelburne, some went to Digby and Annapolis Royal, others went to St. John, at the mouth of the St. John River, transporting in total, it's estimated, in the vicinity of 30,000 loyalists over a six-month period. This included United Empire loyalists as well as Black loyalists.
And to be considered a loyalist per se, was it just a matter you had to have been in those American territories and were evacuated, or I know with some of the soldiers that served, they were given land grants, and those are specifically considered loyalists. So is there like a requirement for the military service or just any active service on behalf of the king?
That's right, Brian. There are two different categories of claimants, the military claimants who could have been Americans who resided in the colonies prior to the start of the conflict in 1776 and joined a loyalist regiment and then served throughout the revolution. Examples of that would be the New Jersey Volunteers and the New York Volunteers, the King's Orange Rangers, all based around the New York, New Jersey area, as well as civilian claimants. These were people who provided some type of assistance to the British forces. They could have been merchants, they could have been spies, they could have provided ships, supplies, farming gear, but they had to be able to provide some type of documentation to show, to substantiate that they had done this. Then when they came to Nova Scotia, they were eligible for land grants based on the type of claimant they were. Depending on your military service, the higher rank received the greater number of acreage. Then down to civilian claimants received a basic amount of 100 acres for a civilian. Now, that could increase depending on the number in the family. For children, if in some families when they came, it was quite common to have father, son, brothers, three or more who had all been active in some way in the loyalist cause.
Okay, so it is as simple as the name sounds. You had to be loyal to the king. The military service wasn't required, but that gave you more privileges when you got here, at least as far as land is concerned. So How many loyalists settled in Digby? I know we talked a little bit about this before we actually started recording, in comparison, like other places like Shelburne, which St. John, which are more sort of where you've, a lot of people think where a lot of the loyalists wound up.
Well, initially there were seven ships that left New York. The first ship to arrive was the Atlanta. In total, slightly over 1,300 loyalists. That would include the United Empire loyalists, as well as their servants, also considered to be black slaves who arrived in the area. Now, in addition to that, there was a regiment, a black, free black regiment called the Black Pioneers. They were transported to Annapolis Royal. Subsequently, they petitioned the Nova Scotia House of Assembly for land grants, and to be treated no differently, not to be discriminated against in receiving land grants. So the Nova Scotia Assembly created a settlement outside of the town of Digby called Brindley Town, 76 one-acre lots, which were provided to each of these former Black Pioneers. Now, as events transpired, perhaps as many as 80% of them left to Sierra Leone in the departure of a large number of the Black loyalists who decided to go there and have the opportunity to return to their homeland and have what they perceived to be greater freedom.
Definitely. I mean, you said they petition have equal status. 1 acre parcels does not seem as equal as, you know, the 100 for the non,
well, the
civilian.
The loyalists that arrived in Digby, initially they were eligible for town lots. And the town lots, again, were of a smaller size as well. The difficulty which was experienced in both cases was there was a shortage of supplies and a shortage of surveyors. So the creation of the town lots and the survival of the settlement was in jeopardy from the beginning. The Digby was almost faced with famine the first spring because the ship bringing supplies from Britain due to unfortunate prevailing winds arrived late. And then the people were provided lots just by number and not by location or measurement or size. So it led to mass confusion as to where the properties might be situated and where they could be situated. There was a common assignment of property to blacks and free blacks and United Empire loyalists on St. Mary's Bay. However, at that time as well, in order to, you received the land free, which meant that you didn't have to pay for it to be surveyed, but you had to live up to certain conditions. You had to occupy it. You had to improve it. If you didn't do that, then it could fall back to the crown. The difficulty as well in Digby's case, when it was chosen as a site, don't forget, we all remember the expulsion of the Acadians, which had happened decades before this. Well, after they had left or been dispersed, the planters arrived from New England. And the planters largely received the most fertile land up the valley. And land around Halifax was already spoken for. So when the loyalists did arrive, there wasn't a lot of choice as to where to put them. The ones that came to Digby that was selected largely because instead of New Brunswick, the military regiments that I had mentioned, their commanders had their eye on the St. John River. They wanted to settle their soldiers together for defensive purposes. In the event of any future conflict, it would be easier to call them up and assemble them to protect the area.
I mean, that makes sense. It's unfortunate they chose St. John for Digby's sake. I mean, it could have been much different history of the community. Now, of those settlers, you said that those loyalists that originally arrived, that there's still a fair percentage of people that would be able to derive that they are part of that loyalist group, where, compared to some other places where they sort of dispersed.
Yes, when we think of the loyalists, in looking through the records, probably approximately 70% of these were Americans. They had lived in the U.S. for a few generations, and for whatever reason, they had decided they just didn't want to be part of the revolution. Then the remainder seemed to have been, the largest group I've come across were Irish, interestingly enough, then Scots, then German and Dutch, and then, well, apart from that, would be the Black loyalists. However, it's not as easy to put a number on them, because some of the white loyalists, the United Empire loyalists who came, the more affluent ones, because they were coming from America where slavery still existed, brought with them and identified them as servants, when in fact they were actually Black slaves. The Nova Scotia situation became more complicated because, unlike the U.S., see, then in Digby, you had free Blacks in Brindleytown, and then you had Black slaves also in Digby with United Empire loyalists. So it encouraged within the next 30 years, the abolition of slavery within Nova Scotia.
I was going to say, yeah, it was shortly thereafter that Nova Scotia, I think Nova Scotia was one of the first British colonies to completely abolish slavery, was it not?
Well, Ontario got a head start in 1798 as Simcoe, Sir John Simcoe. He actually passed a law forbidding the trade in slaves. So that was the beginning of it. Here in the early 1800s, in 1810, 21 slave owners in Annapolis and Digby County signed a petition, which they sent to the Nova Scotia House of Assembly. They were so fearful that slavery was going to be abolished, requesting compensation in the event that slavery was abolished, because you see, they were using this free labor on their farms or in their households. The petition never became law, which we'd like to hear.
Yeah.
And it was shortly after that slavery per se disappeared. However, the consequences of it, as we know, have carried on for many years and are with us today.
Definitely. It's interesting to see, though, the historical prerogative, and I can imagine it, that's probably one of the choice why a lot of the Black loyalists went to Sierra Leone, because they saw their neighbors possibly that were still enslaved and looking for that freedom, or wondering what's going to ultimately happen to them.
I think a lot of it too was the Black loyalists, as with the United Empire loyalists, hadn't experienced a Nova Scotia winter. And this was a lot of the Black slaves in particular, picture them coming from Georgia and North Carolina up here to face this, and then not receiving the promised, let alone land, food supplies or necessities of life. That is why close to or greater than 50% of the white loyalists were gone. The United Empire loyalists were gone within 5 years. And a lot of them returned to the American colonies. Some went on to Ontario, some went to New Brunswick. It was just too great a challenge. And here in Digby, you see, the greatest asset we have is the sea and the fishery. but a lot of these loyalists were farmers. That was a skill they didn't have. They would have to transition to that, and that took time as well. But there are exceptions to the rule. I've come across deeds where a free black man in the early 1800s, 1801, was able to purchase 200 acres of land. And he was a descendant of one of the, a son of one of the black pioneers. That was just outside of Digby. It makes you wonder a little bit in the circumstances. I think partly too, some of the, there were different shades of slavery, and some of the United Empire loyalists, they freed their servants or their black slaves not that long after they arrived here, or in their will they made provision for them to be freed, or depending on their own circumstances, if they left and depending on the availability of land, they may have had an arrangement with them for some conveyance of land. I think there were both extremes.
That's interesting. I think, yeah, that's often a lot of times when we look at history, we forget to look at that side of it, that there was not everybody, it needs to be categorized the same way just because of perception.
In this book, recent book, Loyalists of Digby, I do give an example which shows that, I mean, the black loyalists were connected to Digby all over. The location of the Admiral Digby Well, which is prominent downtown Digby, historically connected to the loyalists when they arrived here. Well, the loyalists that owned that property, Jonathan Fowler, there's a document in the public archives showing him selling a young black slave. So he was a slave owner. And then just outside of Digby, the Acaciaville Baptist Church, which is one of the members of the black churches across Nova Scotia, Baptist churches across Nova Scotia. It is on land that was previously owned by Isaac Hatfield. Colonel Isaac Hatfield was also a prominent loyalist and owned slaves in Digby. So you can't really distinguish between the early years in terms of the loyalist settlement here between the United Empire loyalists and the black loyalists. They were closely connected. I think what's helped to save the Digby community in part was that its location, again, right across from St. John, and immigrants from other parts of Europe that were starting to arrive in the early 1800s, although perhaps slightly more than 50% of the United Empire loyalists and less than that of the black loyalists remained, the community thrived because it also started to receive immigrants from Europe and other places due to its location on the Annapolis Basin and the Bay of Fundy.
And you mentioned the people exiting, but then there was that, like you said, just said, the coming in of new people. Did loyalists from other areas resettle in Digby eventually? Was there that type of movement as well? Was there anything that would have attracted people if they could bear the winters, I guess?
Well, you hit on a good point there. I mean, they were arriving in places like Shelburne and spending the first winter in a tent. Hard to fathom that, but some of the loyalists from Shelburne relocated to the Digby area and to Weymouth. The Campbell family was a good example of it. They located down to Weymouth, and one of them became the Registrar of Deeds, and then another the Member of Parliament for this area. As well, Port Mattoon on the South Shore. Largely, I think the loyalists were just looking to survive somewhere, and if it was difficult where they were and they heard of an opportunity somewhere else in the province, that's where they went. When Shelburne started to dissipate after its receipt of over 10,000 loyalists to begin with, and then within two decades was down to 300, they went everywhere. Some even went to Sydney. Some went to where you are there in Prince Edward Island. So wherever they heard about an opportunity for land or a possibility to advance their position and their family's fortune.
And the loyalists that did stay in Digby, their history, what impact did they have on the community besides the original founding? You mentioned the land that's granted for that Baptist church. I mean, is it obvious if I was to go to Digby today, would there be things that would be obviously be able to say this is here because of a loyalist, or there's a person, a specific loyalist that made an impact on Nova Scotian history, whether it's politicians, ministers, possibly, I'm thinking, those people that would have a sort of that lasting impact to today that somebody would see?
Well, one example might be Thomas Millage, who was one of the loyalists. He had been an officer in the New Jersey Volunteers, and he was a surveyor as well. They needed surveyors desperately. The town grid of the town plot of Digby today is what it was in the 1780s when the town was established. Carleton Street was named after Sir Guy Carleton, George Street after King George III. Along the water, there's an Admiral's Walk with a cairn to the United Empire Loyalists that was placed there by Lieutenant Governor Schaffner for the bicentennial of the Loyalists back in the 1980s. On the outskirts of the town, you'll find the Black Cemetery, which is in the location of where Brinley Town formerly was. It's kind of the last remnant of Brinley Town. And then certainly down on the waterfront on Montague Row, you have the Admiral Digby Museum, which figures prominent, and it has an extensive genealogical collection. I would say that it's noticeable. But Digby has, over the years, by and large, Digby is known as the world capital of scallops, you know, and fishing, and its fishing fleet, and its harbor. So that catches a lot of interest, and its seafood. You know, people will come here for that. Once they get here, they may notice that near the center of the town still is Trinity Anglican Church. Trinity was named by the Loyalists who came from New York after Trinity to Anglican in New York City. In its cemetery, the earliest grave is from, the earliest headstone is for Mary Getches, 1785. Her husband, Jacob Getches, came from Philadelphia. He captained a sloop that brought Black Loyalists to Annapolis Royal. Then he turns up on the assignment of lots in the town of Digby and also outside of the town of Digby. Tragically, his wife apparently didn't survive 2 years. I don't know if she was a victim of famine or conditions or what. He departed Digby. He was one of those loyalists who left, like a lot of others. However, I found him in Halifax. He relocated to Halifax, where he was taxed as the captain of a ship. So he continued on in the merchant trade. And he remarried. However, he didn't survive another 10 years because his wife remarried again after that and shows herself as a widow at that time. But the cemetery of Trinity Church contains over 200 headstones and many of them are original loyalists, so who started to be buried there in the 1780s through the early 1800s. As well, you'll pass on the main street leaving town, Warwick Street, the old Loyalist Cemetery, and it has a sign on it, 1783. This was a private cemetery that was first established on the land of Henry Rutherford. Henry Rutherford was originally believed to have been from Cork, Ireland. He resettled in New York shortly before the American Revolution, started up a mercantile business there with George Nash. George Nash, I've traced back to Scotland. He actually appears on the listing for property because he was assigned a lot in the town and a town lot, and his ethnicity is shown as Scottish. So there you go, Brian.
George is actually the person I'm trying to make a connection to.
He's buried in the cemetery, yeah. In that cemetery, Trinity in Digby. And it's quite an impressive location. And the cemetery stones, because of their age, unfortunately, a lot of them haven't survived that well. But there's a lot of history there. And the church is a rebuilt church because the first one, there was a fire. However, in that church, there are some beautiful glass windows. And at one end, there's three to the Vetts family. Roger Vetts was the first minister of the church and a loyalist who came from New Hampshire. Okay. He's buried in that cemetery. In fact, he's buried at one end of the church.
So, yeah, that's when they used to bury people writing in the church.
He requested that he be buried at one end of the church.
Yeah. Now, the cemetery records, you said the stones are aged, as you would expect. Are there sources where there's good transcripts? If I want to see those records, is there a repository at where those are available that would be indexed or able to be seen?
Well, I've also, in an earlier book I did, I published on the cemeteries and gravestones of Loyalist cemeteries and gravestones of Digby and Annapolis County. I include a great number of those from that cemetery, photographs as well as the inscriptions and identifying the symbols that appear on the stones. There's further information at the Admiral Digby Museum. And during the summer, they open the church. They have a summer student for tours. And they have a handout which lists and identifies all the stones to help you if you want to go out and try to find an ancestor and look at that stone.
Okay. Now, would there be those names that are prominent in that community that lasted? You've mentioned a few of them that have sort of lasted in the community there, that if I know that I have ancestors from Nova Scotia and I'm suspecting they might have been loyalists coming from Digby, other than the time frame, I guess, would you be a good clue. But if they settled in the 1783, they
arrived
settled
in 1783, yes.
And was there any other arrival times after?
Well, no, they had, the Loyalists had started in June, the first ship arrived, and then by the fall, all of the Loyalists had arrived in Digby. Now, there's also evidence, in the area, driving down Digby Neck, some of the Loyalists who dispersed from Digby went to Rossway. You'll find Timpany Lane, named after Robert Timpany. He was another Loyalist originally from Ireland. Right down Digby Neck, Sandy Cove, and Centerville, the Tituses. The Tituses were originally assigned lots in the town, and they relocated. Even Tiverton on Long Island. Tiverton was founded by Robert Outhouse. Robert Outhouse was a Loyalist from New York. He and his brothers came originally to the area, and he was one of the co-founders of Tiverton. He returned to New York and then with his daughter ended up going to Ontario, but his son, other family members remained in Tiverton. And right at the very tip of Digby County there in Westport as well, you'll find Loyalists. I don't know if you remember that they have a new ferry that crosses the passage there, Margaret's Justice. Mm-hmm. It's named after Margaret Davis, who was married to Ethel Davis, both Loyalists. He had served in the American Revolution. They're buried in the cemetery in Westport. And if you're down that way, you can take the trip across the ferry named after her and then visit them in the cemetery, which is quite an historic connection. She's the lady that illustrates the land dispute again. Her deed was in question. She didn't receive a proper deed. Well, she walked to Halifax. Wow. She walked to Halifax to get a proper deed and appear before a judge and signed an affidavit after her husband had died. He was deceased many years. She didn't walk the entire way. She took, apparently traveled by ship from Westport up to Annapolis Royal and then overland from Annapolis Royal to Halifax. That's why they call the ferry Margaret's Justice. She finally got what was owed to her.
Wow, that's quite the story. That should be a movie, almost. I didn't know that story.
It's reflective of the Loyalist experience here too, though, with the land title issue I mentioned. In fact, the land title issue wasn't cleared up until what was called the Hatfield Grant, which came in the 1800s. Before that, they'd had the Botsford Grant, the first grant of land. Amos Botsford was a Connecticut lawyer, also a loyalist, who was appointed by Sir Guy Carleton to help settle the loyalists in Digby. And he was initially granted land here too, but I don't know if he found the going too tough, but he relocated when the province of New Brunswick was created in 1784 due to the great number of loyalists there. He moved to New Brunswick and became a justice of the peace, a registrar of deeds, and a politician in Westmoreland County, New Brunswick.
Okay. And so was that typical? Would you normally have to go all the way to Halifax? I mean, that's a fair trip even in a car nowadays, let alone walking or other means to get court actions settled.
Well, I mentioned that grant, that Hatfield grant, the reason for it was that a petition was signed by many of the loyalists in Digby County and presented by their member of the House of Assembly. Normally that's the way it would be done. And requesting that the township be resurveyed simply because of the confusion with the original grants and the property lines and boundaries. And there were some people occupying land that in the wrong location, and the loyalists themselves couldn't afford to do that, the cost of having the survey done. So under pressure from the people of Digby, the government had a new survey done. And it was named Hatfield because the Hatfield family was a large loyalist family who received sizable land grant.
Okay. And did that survey wind up, what kind of effect did it actually cause more dispersion or movement of people because they were in the wrong spots?
It was needed and it helped, I think. But in some places, I mean, I practiced law in Digby for many years. And some surveyors refused to go down to Long Island or Westport, because when the survey was done for those islands, originally the surveyor didn't go there. He looked at the islands on a piece of paper and divided it up. So they found out when you go down there, there's actually less land than what the map shows, you see, because the map doesn't correspond to with what's on the ground. So you have lots overlapping each other and property boundaries overlapping each other. So it's a surveyor's nightmare to try to figure out who is entitled to what. So then they get into arguments over possession, you know, and examples of what's been used and where their boundary line was and how long did they have it there for and the rest of it.
So it's still causing issues today.
Yes.
Wow. Well, that's, I guess, one lasting impact of the Loyalist settlement there for sure.
But the other thing that the Loyalists did by coming here, and although it was difficult, they contributed greatly to the infrastructure. Members of the first families were involved in building the first road to Weymouth, the first road to Bear River, establishing infrastructure for the town to encourage new immigrants when they came to the area to remain.
Now, I'm trying to remember, it's been a while since I've been to Digby and spent any amount of time actually in the town. Are there the houses of some of these original settlers, are they still there, and are they like prominently marked? So,
unfortunately, Digby had some major fires that swept through here, and everything was wooden. And if you want to see original Loyalist era buildings, there's a street in Annapolis Royal, a 20-minute drive away, and just around the corner from Fort Ann on George Street, there are several houses that are marked as homes. There's an information board across from the homes identifying them. The Bailey House is one of them, and they can be seen online as well.
Okay, yes, I remember those from Annapolis Royal visiting there. Okay, well, that's a... It's all quite interesting. I really am enjoying this. Now, talking about the Loyalists in general in Nova Scotia, you mentioned you're the president of the Loyalist Association. Now, I know that there's a designation somebody, if they have loyalty heritage, they can get. How does a person start that? Where's the best place to start if I want to prove that my ancestor is this loyalist, besides the if I have all my genealogical evidence there, what do I need to do?
You're referring to the Dorchester's resolution of the UE. Yeah. At the end of the American Revolution, Sir Guy Carleton, Lord Dorchester, he wanted to recognize the contribution of the Loyalists, and he indicated that those who had served could use the initials UE as a post-nominal, UE standing for United Empire. Now, interestingly enough, the UE, United Empire, was first used prior to the American Revolution by a drinking establishment in Boston. Of people that were loyal to the United Empire. However, when this began, it was started at the time Dorchester was dealing with land grants in Ontario, and it was intended to be of assistance. And in Ontario, they actually picked up on it. And in the original land grants, you'll see, like for my ancestor, it mentions he, James Humphrey UE, received these lands. Ontario was the only province to use this, and they established lists of UE. And Sir John Graves Simcoe continued with that in the 1800s. It wasn't really used and didn't appear in the literature in the Maritimes until the 1800s, and then they picked up on it. But you see, the United Empire Loyalist Association provides a certificate of descent. And on that certificate of descent, it refers to this Dorchester Resolution and the UE. And that's how people make the association. In order to receive a certificate of descent, you can only receive one if you first belong to a branch of the association. There are 28 branches across Canada and a virtual branch on the internet, which people can join, and for a small fee in their area, probably of depends on a family membership or single membership, but it's well under $100. You will be assisted by a branch genealogist who will provide you with the forms. And generally, what you have to show is your connection back to this original person who there is evidence to show was loyal to the crown during the American Revolution. So the evidence they ideally want to see are birth, death, marriage certificates. However, that type of evidence was not available around the close of the American Revolution. So it's easiest if your ancestor was in the military, as in my case, because then they appear in a muster roll. So I was able to find him in the muster roll. And then as well, he's referred to in the list of grant. And those grants are now online, Public Archives of Canada, on their website. They have all of the grants and they're searchable. So people can look up that and find those ancestors. But it's really a process of getting together the right documentation and paperwork. You may be also assisted in that because the association has been going on for over 100 years. It was founded in 1914. And in the last two decades, there's been a tremendous increase in interest in finding one's roots in genealogy. The branch you join or another branch may already have proven you're a loyalist. And if they've already proven you're a loyalist, that can be of assistance to you. In if they're willing to share the information with you, you'll be able to just connect the most of it back. It'll just be the more recent years to your own identification.
So do these associations, Lisa, they have branch genealogists and stuff, do they have, you know, records that it'd make it worthwhile for a person if they're interested in pursuing that, becoming a member, that they would have access to more sets of records that might just not be available publicly?
Every branch, yes, every branch does keep all their applications. Okay. And the records, and as well, they're stored in at Dominion Office.
Okay.
In Toronto. And there is a list right now, it's being updated, but online on the website of the association, there's a loyalist list. And it has, it includes proven loyalists as well as ones that are possibly loyalists. But I've some members will include their information. I've included my information there. So if someone had the same ancestor as me, they would be able to go there and open it up and it's all there. They could find the route all the way back to their loyalist ancestor.
Okay. That's, I mean, I know in the United States, a lot of these associations type things are important to people, but I know they do actually help in your overall genealogical research because they might have, like I said, that information that you kind of are missing or... So,
well, an example, Brian, of this was I know of some people who have, say, four loyalist ancestors, and these four of the four, two might be in Nova Scotia and two might be in Ontario. Yeah. Well, in order to assist in their research, they'll join several branches. They join the Nova Scotia branch, knowing that the branch genealogist here will have the expertise and the access to the records and may have even proven their ancestor before. And then the branch in Ontario with the same hope.
Okay. That definitely makes sense, especially like you said, when we were talking earlier with some of the dispersions and the different groupings of where they wound up going. So you just finished this book and so what else do you have coming down the pipeline?
Well, I've been doing more detailed research on the loyalists in this area, and one of the common questions I'm always asked is about the someone can't find any information on their particular loyalist. So you can find your loyalist if he received a land grant, but quite often they didn't stay long enough to get the grant. They arrived here and they were assigned the lot, but they left for Ontario or back to the States or somewhere else before then. And in some records, like you can find the assignment. So I've been looking at some of those lately now and am giving some thought to putting together another book, which would list these loyalists that are difficult to find because they don't necessarily appear in the land records or the registries, but they were part of the movement from the United States to Canada.
Okay. Speaking of that, if I was, for instance, somebody that was settled in Digby, but I couldn't have hacked the winter, would I then be able to go apply for another grant in a different area of Canada? Or was that common? Or if I had applied for that grant, even if I didn't use it, I was sort of out of the loop. I was out of luck.
It depends on the circumstance. Some of them stayed for a short time. Some of them stayed for decades. If they became established and they sold their land, you see, then they'd be carrying on. Initially, it would depend on their documentation as to what they were eligible to receive. Generally speaking, no. A lot of them, when they moved around, did so just because of survival. You know, but at this time, Ontario was opening up too, you see, and they were looking to encourage people from not just loyalists, but sometimes people that came from the States that are referred to as late loyalists. They came up during the 1790s or 1800s, you see, and they didn't receive these land grants, but why did they come? Because they didn't want to live under the American. There was also this, a lot of people, British, didn't think that the American Republic would survive. They thought that in a few years they would come back to the UK asking them to take them back in again. That it was considered to be, you know, like mob rule, this experience with democracy.
I know a few Americans that still think that. I think they're still waiting for the UK to come back. I've seen the meme with the Queen wearing the red baseball cap that says "Make America Great Britain Again." So there wouldn't have been that much of that. Now, just the sort of the last couple of questions I was thinking about tying in with the previous book we talked about, the Ulster Scots. Now, you mentioned a few Irish people that were loyalists. Now, would they have also tended to be Ulster Scots, or would they be the mix of the Irish and the Protestant Scots that would be have come over?
Well, judging by the surnames, there definitely were some Ulster Scots. However, I think that they came from all over Ireland. I mean, given this time period, you have to remember that Ireland itself has evolved and changed.
Yeah.
You know, at one time, Dublin, the Guinness Brewery, and there were a great number of Anglo-Irish or Scotch-Irish living in Dublin area, and the same throughout other parts of Ireland. And I believe that when Ireland was part of the British Empire, young Irish would serve in British regiments around the world. And that may be a way that some of them ended up in America, you know, and that they carried on as loyalists after that service and came here. But there are there other examples, as I mentioned, that Henry Rutherford, who teamed up with George Nash in Digby. He is supposed to have come from Cork, but they were both Presbyterians, according to initially, but they changed to Anglican, and they're buried in the Trinity Church there, possibly because, I mean, Anglican was the state religion.
Yeah.
And that was the, if you wanted to be part of the community and active in the community, that was your only choice.
And there wasn't a lot of other established churches Protestant churches necessarily until a little bit after.
Although there was an infusion of Scots, I noticed, interestingly enough, and there was a Methodist church and a Presbyterian church that got established next in Digby.
Okay.
So following the Loyalists.
So, and I know we didn't really bring this up, but you brought it up through the thing. When you think of Digby, a lot of people know that the town, it's also the county, and it's the wider county where we're talking about the settlement in general. And again, it sounds...
That's right. As I was mentioning, some of the Loyalists in Digby who didn't remain traveled to other parts of the township, to Weymouth, and also down to Sandy Cove and Tiverton and Westport. And some went directly to Weymouth when they first arrived. Then it was on the Sissabou River. There was another community there, New Edinburgh, named after Edinburgh, Scotland, which failed. It was started up, actually the concept for it before Digby. And Bishop Inglis, Charles Inglis, who I mentioned in the book on Canada's Ulster Scots, he actually was on the initial list of owners of land. They laid out a town lot for New Edinburgh. It's just on the other side of the Sissabou River at the mouth of the harbor coming into Weymouth. If you think about crossing the bridge there into Clare, it would be on the Clare side of Digby County. Well, up until the early 1900s, I've read that you could still walk New Edinburgh and find the old streets. It was all laid out.
Wow.
But this community only lasted about 15 years due to its location possibly, and it wasn't able to encourage new settlement. And it was the old title issue thing. There were already some Acadians living in the area who had claimed to some of the land. But it was called New Edinburgh because the group of Loyalists coming from New York who decided to settle there, the group of four, were all from Scotland. And I guess they wanted to recall their homeland when they came to Nova Scotia.
I mean, definitely they were moving to New Scotland, so might as well have a New Edinburgh there, right?
Yeah.
Well, I do want to thank you, Brian. It was a pleasure, as always. And I'm looking forward to more coming from you in books. So where can I get your new book? I know it's available on Amazon.
It's available online, and as well it will be, as I mentioned, in the Admiral Digby Museum in Digby. I'm also providing signed copies, autographed copies to people. If they want to contact me, I'll be happy to make arrangements with them. And they can probably find me through, I'm on Instagram.
Okay.
And just send me a message and I'll be happy to assist them.
And I'll definitely link that in my show notes here on the podcast. I really do appreciate you coming today. It was great talking to you again, and you have a great day.
Thanks for the opportunity, Brian. Bye. And same to you.
Wow, well, that's the second time I've had Brian on the show, and I really do appreciate him, and I always learn something interesting every time I talk to him. I'm just still sort of dumbfounded and in awe of the lady who walked from Digby to Halifax to secure her land. I was talking to Brian after we recorded this. She was 60 years old at the time. He didn't mention that. And that just makes it more astounding. Just did a quick Google map search. And on the highways that exist today now, that are quite, it's a pretty good highway going down through that area now. It's 228 kilometers from this town of Digby to the legislature building in Halifax. which would be downtown, it'd be the area of, that she would have went to, either to the legislature or the courts, somewhere around there. But that's 228 kilometers. I just can't believe it. That's a long walk, especially for somebody 60. I'm pushing 50, and I couldn't walk it. I don't think I could. I definitely couldn't. Just tells you the sort of the things our ancestors had to do just to secure their own property. Anyways, that was a great discussion. I really, like I said, I really enjoyed it. I hope you did too. Now this part of the show, to the last couple episodes, I've been doing a series on the census. I'm going to actually skip over that for this week. We will be getting back to that in a future episode. I just want to talk to you about a few things that are coming up. St. Patrick's Day is coming up March 17th, and I actually have an episode that will be dropping that day, and I'm looking forward to it. But the other thing that I'm looking forward to is I'm planning on doing a little bit of a fundraiser for on St. Patrick's Day for Parkinson's. My listeners who don't know that I was actually diagnosed with Parkinson's back in 2014, so almost 2013, I think it was now. So almost 8 years ago, 8 years ago this August. I've been pretty lucky, and it hasn't been too severe for me. I do occasionally have tremors and stuff, so I'm going to be doing something on St. Patrick's Day. I'm going to do a 24-hour live cast. I'm going to attempt it, and it's going to be a fundraiser for the Parkinson's Society, or actually the Michael J. Fox charity. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to push me to my limits. It's going to be like that 228-kilometer walk. It's going to be 24 hours for me, and so I'm looking kind of forward. And I'm just, I'm going to invite you there. So I'm just to join me. I'll be posting some things more on my Twitter and on my Facebook page as I get closer. But in the meantime, I invite you to come go to my website, www.howwegothere.ca, and my YouTube page. You can find the links there and the links to all my content on my webpage. And remember to follow me on Twitter as well. And I really do look forward to hearing more from you. And I want to thank you and remind you to keep looking for your ancestors.
Thank you for listening to this episode of How We Got Here. Make sure you check out the show notes for more information about today's topic and guests. How We Got Here is hosted and produced by Brian Nash. Title music from Tribute to O'Carolan by Luna Bajowski.